whom he will spend eternity, but the actual source of these additional Christian beliefs is the Bible and the theology he has built on it. What I'm doing here by contrast is showing why we cannot believe the Bible or the supposed good God it speaks about. If we have no good reason to believe the Bible or its God, then the question of whether there is a supernatural force or being out there is an uninteresting academic one for people only interested in that sort of thing as a curiosity. For if that's all we can conclude, then there is no way to know what this force or being wants us to do, why we're here, or where we're going when we die, then it ends up being an unnecessary hypothesis, even if it's true. No one who believes in such a nebulous supernatural force or being would even care to engage in writing a book like this one. The one topic in our book that gets to the heart of what Rouser believes was on the resurrection of Jesus in chapter 19. I don't think the brain of an apologist like him can appreciate the impact of what I'm about to say, but here goes. Jesus may well have been raised bodily from the grave by his God. Fine, I can grant that for the sake of argument, even though I don't think that this Easter event happened at all. The problem is that there just isn't a reasonable way to know if he did, and the only tools we have to determine if he did are the tools of the historian. I wrote a whole important chapter on this topic. Here's how a historian must look at the miracles of the resurrection of Jesus, as explained by New Testament scholar Bart Ehrman. All that historians can do is show what probably happened in the past. That is the problem inherent in miracles. Miracles, by our very definition of the term, are virtually impossible events, so miracles, by their very nature, are always the least probable explanations for what happened. And he gives us this example. Suppose that Jesus was buried by Joseph of Arimathea, and then a couple of Jesus' followers, not among the 12, decided that night to move the body somewhere more appropriate. But a couple of Roman legionaries were passing by and catch these followers carrying the shroud corpse through the streets. They suspect foul play and confront the followers, who pull their swords as the disciples did in Gethsemane. The soldiers, expert in swordplay, kill them on the spot. They now have three bodies and no idea where the first one came from. Not knowing what to do with them, they commandeered a cart and take the corpses out to Gehenna, outside town, and dump them. Within 3 or 4 days, the bodies had deteriorated beyond recognition. Jesus' original tomb is empty and no one seems to know why. Is this scenario likely? Not at all. Am I proposing this is what really happened? Absolutely not. Is it more probable that something like this happened than a miracle happened and Jesus left the tomb to ascend to heaven? Absolutely. From a purely historical point of view, a highly unlikely event is far more probable than a virtually impossible one. Even Christian professor Dale Allison admits, with regard to the pivotal claim of the resurrection of Jesus, that the accounts of the resurrection, like the past in general, come to us as phantoms. Most of the reality is gone. It is the fragmentary and imperfect nature of the evidence, as well as the limitations of our historical critical tools, that move us to confess, if we are conscientious, how hard it is to recover the past. That something happened does not entail our ability to show that it happened, and that something did not happen does not entail our ability to show that it did not happen. Pure historical reasoning is not going to show us that God raised Jesus from the dead. Christian professor James McGrath said the same thing about the historian's dilemma, that all sorts of fairly improbable scenarios are inevitably going to be more likely than an extremely improbable one. That doesn't necessarily mean miracles never happened then or don't happen now. It just means that historical tools are not the way to answer that question. The bottom line is that the tools of the historian are inadequate for the task of detecting miracles, but the tools of the historian are all we've got to know if an extremely improbable miraculous event like a resurrection happened. There is no other method. So even if the resurrection of Jesus did happen, we cannot know that it did. That's the point of Ehrman. That's the point of Allison. That's the point of McGrath. To claim anything beyond what the tools of the historian lead us to conclude is special pleading one's case. Troeltsch's principle of analogy. One of the tools of the historian is Ernst Troeltsch's principle of analogy. Troeltsch was an important German theologian, 1865 to 1923, who argued that the laws of nature operate the same for the past as well for the present. So when investigating the past for what happened, historians must assume the present is the key to the past, and that the laws of nature were the same for people in biblical times as they are for our present day. The consequence of his principle is that if miracles do not happen in the present, then they did not happen in the ancient past either. That's because the laws of nature have not changed. Peter Crawford said of it, "The principle of analogy, which is one of the basic principles of all societal scientific study, is not restricted to the skeptical historian, but applies to all historiography as well as to everyday life. There is no other option but to apply it to present practical standards of everyday life to determine whether the decision of the historian to reject the claims of some events narrated in ancient sources is valid." I find there to be nothing controversial about this principle at all. It's obvious. We must assume this about the past. Christians can argue that it's possible the world behaved differently in the past all they want to, but it's not possibility that matters, only probability does. If God expects us to believe based upon a mere possibility that the world was different in the past than in our own day, then he's not expecting us to be the reasonable people he supposedly created us to be. How believers respond to Trolsch is characterized by both Michael Lacona and Alvin Plantinga. Lacona questions the antecedent probabilities that show us miracle claims in history always turn out to be false, or to be very generous, almost always. That's the probabilities given Trolsch's principle. Lacona argues that in order to empirically establish these probabilities, it would require investigating all miracle claims. But since that would be impossible, he asks how we can really know uniform experience is always against the occurrence of miraculous events. Lacona, investigating every miracle claim would be a seemingly impossible task, thus rendering the assertion that the uniform experience of reality supports the non-existence of miracles equally impossible to support. However, we emphatically don't need to investigate all miracle claims to establish the principle of analogy, just enough of them to show it to be very improbable. We're not looking for certainty, nor do we need it, so any possible loophole seems fair game to Lacona. Maybe some miracles have actually occurred. The tools we have to determine whether miracles took place don't lead us to that conclusion. When historians investigate miracle claims on our behalf by doing it correctly, they always conclude there isn't enough evidence to turn an improbability into a probability. In fact, it's precisely because we cannot investigate all miracle claims that we must come up with some sort of conclusion about the antecedent probabilities when assessing if the particular one of them took place. There is no other alternative. When historians do this, miracle claims always turn out to be false. Because Lacona doesn't think uniform experience is against miracles, he argues we must consider miracle claims on a case-by-case basis, rather than adopt the antecedent probability showing that miracle claims in history always turn out to be false. Lacona suggests we should dismiss the antecedent probabilities and investigate miracle claims in isolation from each other. He does this so he can proceed to investigate the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus without factoring in the antecedent probabilities that miracle claims in history always turn out to be false. In fact, Lacona says that by placing too much value on antecedent probability in historical judgments, the historian is many times forced to make conclusions that are incorrect. Well then, when it comes to miracle claims in history, which ones, other than Lacona's beliefs in the resurrection of Jesus, does he think historians have gotten wrong when they reject them all as improbable? He doesn't say. Presumably based on his evangelical faith, he thinks most of the miracles reported in the Bible took place as reported. What reasonable basis would he have for concluding that if historians with their tools don't conclude the same thing? This is the question. Lacona says historians would neither presuppose nor a priori exclude the possibility of God's invention in human affairs. This is fine as it goes. Many historians are themselves believers. But once again, Bart Ehrman tells us the problem. Since historians can establish only what probably happened in the past, they cannot show that miracles happened, since this would invoke a contradiction, that the most improbable event is the most probable. Ehrman explains, a historical occurrence is a one-time proposition. Once it has happened, it is over and done with. Since historians cannot repeat the past in order to establish what probably happened, there will always be less certainty in their conclusions. And the farther back you go in history, the harder it is to mount a convincing case. For events in the ancient world, even events of earth-shattering importance, there is often scant evidence to go on. This is what makes alleged miracles so problematic. On one level, of course, everything that happens is to some extent improbable. As to events that defy all probability, miracles create an inescapable dilemma for historians. Since historians can only establish what probably happened in the past, and the chances of a miracle happening by definition are infinitesimally remote, historians can never demonstrate that a miracle probably happened. By arguing the miracle claims must be judged on an individual basis, Lacona simply dismisses the antecedent probabilities that force him to reasonably shoulder the burden of proof when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus, since those probabilities show that miracle claims in history always turn out to be false. He wants to examine the resurrection of Jesus in isolation from any antecedent probabilities, since in order to succeed, he must do that. He wants to make the resurrection of Jesus out to be special case deserving of special treatment by virtue of special pleading, without a special justification for doing so. He ends up opening up a gaping hole in the dam for other religionists to float their own miracle claims through it, who can now demand the same consistent kind of special pleading. then nothing will stop believers from arguing their miracle claims are exceptions too, rendering the antecedent probabilities null and void, even though the antecedent probabilities still tell us the rule that miracle claims in history always turn out to be false. Just think of what Bart Ehrman argued. To agree with an ancient person that Jesus healed the sick, walked on water, cast out demons, or raised the dead is to argue first that there were divine persons or magicians walking the earth who could do such things, and second, that Jesus was one of them. In other words, from a historian's perspective, anyone who thinks that Jesus did these miracles has to be willing to principle to concede that other people did them as well, including the pagan holy man Apollonius of Tyana, the emperor Vespasian, and the Jewish miracle worker Hanan ben Dosa. The evidence that is admitted in any of these cases must be admitted in others as well. I cannot help but be reminded of the Egyptian magicians in the story of Moses and the Exodus out of Egypt. When Aaron threw down his staff in front of the pharaohs, it became a snake, we're told. When the Egyptian magicians threw down their staffs, they also became snakes, we're told. Exodus 7:10-12. The magicians were able to do this feat, plus turn water into blood, Exodus 7:19-22, and duplicate the plague of the frogs, Exodus 8:18, just as Moses did. One cannot believe that Moses did these feats unless one also believes the Egyptian magicians did, since the same story tells us them both. Alvin Plantinga, for his part, argued for their whole reason for Trollschian biblical scholarship is because the very practice of science presupposes rejection of the idea of miracle or special divine action in the world. But Trollsch only said we must assume the laws of nature were the same for the people in biblical times as they are for our day. It just so happens that in our day, miracles don't happen. It could have turned out differently had the Christian God continued doing miracles, but it didn't. This is most emphatically not a problem with Trollsch's principle. It's the fault of a God who apparently stopped doing miracles as we became more and more scientifically literate. Why did miracles stop as science progressed? A reasonable person would conclude miracles stopped because they never took place at all. Plantinga goes on to say Trollschian biblical scholarship is elitism run amok, in that it presupposes the philosophical and theological opinion that there isn't any other epistemic avenue to these matters. It presupposes that, for example, faith is not a source of warranted belief or knowledge on these topics, that traditional Christian belief is completely mistaken in taking that the faith is, in fact, a reliable source of true and warranted beliefs on these topics. Faith? How is it possible that faith can be a reliable source for anything? A Mormon or Jehovah's Witness, Muslim or Jew, could say the exact same thing. Faith is the excuse apologists make when special pleading. Faith is no method and is promoted by a lying brain. What about miracles is a religious context? To help neutralize the impact of Trollsch's principle of analogy, Christian apologists have arbitrarily introduced the concept of a religious context for miracles, hoping this can eliminate the burden of proof that is rightfully theirs by virtue of the antecedent probabilities. They argue that the probability of a miracle happening is increased when an extraordinary event occurs in a religious context. Michael Akona argues, we may recognize that an event is a miracle when the event occurs in an environment or context with religious significance. In other words, the event occurs in a context where we might expect a God to act. The stronger the context is charged in this direction, the stronger the evidence becomes that we have a miracle on our hands. Comparing David Hume's hypothetical example where Queen Elizabeth comes to life after dying with the example of the resurrection of Jesus, Lacona says a significant difference exists because the historical matrix in which the data for Jesus' resurrection appears is charged with religious significance, whereas the life of the Queen enjoys no such context. What is he talking about? Lacona offers two analogies. If the 50-year-old atheist who has been blind from birth recovers his sight on a Saturday for no apparent reason, this is merely an anomaly, an unexplained fact. It might be a miracle, but who can say for sure? There just isn't anything that offers us a clue as to why this happened. But if instead the same atheist recovered his sight right after a Baptist preacher visited him out of the blue, prayed, and recited the words to Amazing Grace, "I once was blind, but now I see," then that is a religious context. In such a context, Lacona argues, a physician is justified in thinking a miracle has truly occurred. Lacona's analogies are interesting because they reveal his bias. Please note, Lacona didn't suggest an analogy where the atheist bathed in the Ganges River in India and was subsequently healed of his blindness, nor did he propose one involving a witch doctor's spells or a Catholic nun praying for him in the sanctuary of Our Lady of Lourdes in France. These analogies involve a religious context, too. Besides, even though these are just analogies, from what I can tell, sick, blind, and paraplegic people in charismatic and Pentecostal churches are prayed for every worship service to no avail, sometimes under the same circumstances of this hypothetical story. So even if such an event might actually happen someday, I still would want to ask why so many others are not healed under the same circumstances. Nonetheless, does a religious context add anything significant to the probability that a miracle took place? If it does, then Christian miracle claims in history still have no more probability to them than any others. I could cite an almost endless number of claims of healing and miracles coming from many other religious traditions. Just think of the pagan holy man Apollonius of Tyana, the emperor Vespasian, and the Jewish miracle worker Hanina ben Doza. Do any of these and other miracle claims in history have any more probability to them because they took place in religious contexts? If a religious context increases the probability that a miracle occurred, then this doesn't help Christian apologists, since most all miracles claims come from specific, not always Christian, religious contexts. Neither Lacona nor any other apologist who uses this line of reasoning can claim anything special with regard to their faith. But more to the point, if a religious context adds anything significant to the probability that a miracle took place, it only does so if an extraordinary event took place. First thing first, as they say, one cannot merely hear a faith healer say, "be healed," and conclude anything until it can be established that the person was sick or infirmed and then instantly healed. But that doesn't happen. No faith healer does a long-range clinical study on his subjects. They come into the door, pay their money, get smacked down with the power of the Holy Spirit, fall backwards, claim to be healed out of faith, and leave the stage with no follow-up. The fact is, we're talking about miracle claims in history. We cannot just take the narrator's words that Jesus came up to someone and said, "be healed," upon which the person was healed. We must judge the whole story as we found it, since we were not there to hear Jesus utter these words. What Lacona would have us believe is that the religious context out of biblical miracle story adds any probability to the miracle story itself. Well, no. Consider the miracle stories about Jesus. They spread orally from person to person before being written down in a different language decades later by anonymous authors with agendas who didn't agree with each other. These Gospels were then copied and collected into full manuscripts that are 3 centuries removed from the supposed events. So does a religious context add to these stories as we find them? No. The bottom line is that in my world, miracles do not happen. What world are apologists like Lacona living in? The odds of a resurrection from my experience are 0. I must judge the past from the present knowledge. I cannot reasonably do otherwise. Christians cannot believe based on the raw, uninterpreted historical evidence apart from how they were raised. The only way they can reach this faith-based conclusion is by special pleading, and that's it. If in our world miracles do not happen, then they probably did not happen in first century Palestine either. They must approach said evidence from our present day perspective, where miracles like virgin births, resurrections, and ascensions into the sky do not happen, and that should be the end of it. The minimal facts approach to the resurrection. Gary Habermas and Michael Lacona, just like William Lane Craig in his debates, all stress the facts that most scholars agree on in assessing the case for the resurrection, and then they seek the best hypotheses that explain all of these agreed-upon facts. They do not want to be saddled with the task of first showing that the Gospels are in general historically reliable, writes Craig. Instead, Craig merely has to establish that the Gospel accounts of the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb can be shown to be historically reliable without first showing that the Gospels are, in general, historically trustworthy. Habermas and Lacona tell us about their minimal facts approach in these words. This approach considers only those data that are strongly attested historically, that they are granted by nearly every scholar who studies the subject, even the rather skeptical ones. We present our case using the lowest common denominator of agreed upon facts. This keeps attention on the central issue instead of sidetracking into matters that are irrelevant. What is irrelevant, according to them? The general trustworthiness and inspiration of the Bible. One of the strengths of this approach is that it avoids the debate over the inspiration of the Bible. Too often the objection raised frequently against the resurrection is, well, the Bible has errors, so we can't believe Jesus rose. We can quickly push this to the side. I'm not arguing at this time for the inspiration of the Bible or even its general trustworthiness. Believer and skeptic alike accept the facts I'm using because they are strongly supported. These facts must be addressed. To them, these topics are separate issues. It should be obvious what is wrong with their approach. Habermas and Lacona had previously quoted from Annette Gordon Reed, a law professor of New York Law School, when she said of historical and legal cases, "the evidence must be considered as a whole before a realistic and fair assessment of the possible truth of any story can be made." What Habermas and Lacona are doing is isolating a few so-called minimal facts and treating them separately from the general trustworthiness of the Bible. Non-believers don't agree to this approach, since the trustworthiness of the Bible is indeed relevant to the case for the resurrection of Jesus. What are the so-called agreed-upon facts that Habermas and Lacona are referring to? That 1. Jesus died by crucifixion. 2. His disciples believed he rose and appeared to them. 3. The church prosecutor, Paul, was suddenly converted. 4. James, the brother of Jesus, who was formerly a skeptic, converted. And 5. The tomb of Jesus was empty. Craig, Habermas, and Lacona are looking for the best explanation of their isolated minimal facts based on isolated miracle claims and isolated historical tools. The first thing to note is that not everyone agrees with all of their facts. Muslims, over 1 billion of them, along with skeptics Hugh J. Schoenfield, The Passover Plot, 1965, and Robert Price, disagree with the first one. It's also not agreed that James, the brother of Jesus, was a skeptic at the time Jesus died, or that he was converted as a result of Jesus appearing to him. A number of scholars on both sides of the issue doubt the empty tomb, including Dale Allison and many liberal Christian scholars, something Habermas and Lacona admit. Yet they include the empty tomb as an agreed-upon fact anyway, thus revealing that theirs is not a minimal facts approach after all. They feel justified in including it because Habermas discovered that roughly 75% of scholars on the subject accept the empty tomb as historical fact. This argument from consensus includes a preponderance of evangelical tones written on the subject due to the fact that evangelicals are more interested in it than others. Did Habermas include Muslim scholars in this survey? As far as I know, he still has not produced a list of authors included. Richard Carrier did an expose of this claim in 2013 and says Habermas doesn't give any numbers or name or date any of the items in his sample that are being set in ratio to each other. Habermas doesn't release his data still to this day, even after repeated requests, as some of those requesting it have told me, to his results can't be evaluated. That makes his claim uncheckable, which is a perversion of his peer review process. That basically makes this bogus number propaganda, not the outcome of any genuine research methodology. Apologists look at what non-believers have proposed as alternatives to the resurrection and find them all improbable, thus declaring their faith in Jesus' resurrection to be better explanation than what non-believers offer. What they fail to realize is that non-believers do not have to propose an explanation of these isolated facts at all. We're first and foremost arguing that the New Testament is so riddled with discrepancies and evolved layers of religious tradition from a superstitious era that it leaves a great deal of room for doubt, that it's much more likely no one can know what happened if we take the New Testament at face value, which means Christians have little basis beyond blind, irrational faith for believing Jesus rose from the grave. That's what we're saying. Our conjectures only come after arguing that reasonable people must doubt a straightforward reading of the tales in these texts. Habermas and Lacona ignore the fact that a miraculous resurrection is always going to be more improbable than any improbable speculation about what may have happened instead. Improbable things happen all the time. People get struck by lightning. People win contests against overwhelming odds. So non-miraculous explanations of the resurrection might all be improbable and yet to be better candidates for explaining the evidence, since a miracle is still less likely to be true than those other improbable explanations. Unless Christian scholars can show that these improbable explanations are more improbable than a miracle, and they never do, their argument can't even get off the ground. Methodological naturalism. Another tool of the historian, not completely unlike Trolsch's principle of analogy, is to proceed along the lines of methodological naturalism, which would, in the case of the Bible, treat it like one treats any ancient document. Methodological naturalism, MN, is a proven method whereby scholars assume there is a natural explanation for any event rather than a supernatural one. Scientists and historians limit their research to the study of natural causes. They assume for the sake of fruitful and productive research that all causes are natural ones, not supernatural ones. About the use of methodological naturalism, Professor James McGrath comments, "I don't see how historical study can adopt any other approach any more than criminology can. It will always be theoretically possible that a crime victim died simply because God wanted him dead. But the appropriate response of detectives is to leave the case open. In the same way, it will always be possible that a virgin conceived, but will never be more likely than the stories claiming that developed, like comparable stories about other ancient figures as a way of highlighting the individual's significance. And since historical study deals with probabilities and evidence, to claim that a miracle is historically likely misunderstands the method in question. When there is a crime, do investigators assume a natural cause, or do they assume a law did it? Isn't it more productive to assume a natural cause? And doesn't assuming a natural cause lead to solving crimes? What if we cannot solve that crime? Then what? Should we leap to Allah as the cause, or should we simply suspend judgment? Now, it might be that Allah did the crime. The method doesn't preclude the possibility. It's just that with MN, we cannot come to that conclusion. So using it might not allow us to solve a supernaturally caused crime. I get this. But if assuming a natural cause cannot help us to solve the crime, what other method do we have? As far as I can tell, faith has no method, solves no crimes, and leads to dead ends. If Yahweh exists and did the crime instead, then MN itself doesn't allow us to conclude that he did. Therefore, if Yahweh exists, he must convince reasonable people by other means. And I indicated how he could have done so in chapter 1 of this book. Believers have criticized the use of MN since it places their faith conclusively outside the research of scientists and historians. Christian apologist Dr. Victor Reppert objects, saying, "Methodological naturalism would rule out a supernatural explanation in any event." Continuing, he says, "What is needed is a defeasible version of methodological naturalism that allows for some point at which it is no longer reasonable to apply it. What you have to say is that we have good reason to apply MN to the actual evidence, but there are some possible pieces of evidence which, if we had them, we would have to give up MN and admit to the supernatural. But when someone says there is no method for detecting the supernatural, then I take it they mean what they say. If supernatural activity were to occur, we would be obliged to overlook it no matter what. Even if you argue that there is only reasonable thing to do, you have to face up to the consequence of what it says." Reppert is concerned that the use of MN might exclude supernatural explanations and miraculous events before even examining them. His assumption, like other Christian apologists, is that it would be reasonable to exclude supernatural explanations since those explanations might be the best ones for some kind of unexplainable events. Let's first consider the possibility Reppert is correct, that utilizing MN would, in principle, exclude miraculous explanations and miracle claims from consideration. What if MN cannot detect God's handiwork? If that's the case, then believers must bite the bullet. Just admit MN cannot detect God's handiwork. If it's reasonable to adopt MN when honestly searching for the truth about nature and history, and if this means scientists and historians must suspend judgment rather than conclude God did it, then so be it. Believers like Reppert should just admit that scientists and historians cannot find God. Whose fault would this be, if so? It would be God's fault for setting up the universe such that in order to gain objective knowledge about the nature of and nature of history, scientists and historians must adopt MN. It would be God's fault for not doing miracles today to convince us that he exists. It would be God's fault for providing an incompetent revelation to the superstitious past that lacks sufficient evidence to convert outsiders, a revelation that got so many things wrong in the first place. So there is nothing about MN that is unjustified, even if it excludes supernatural explanations. Christian believers use MN every single day. They do not assume that is a demon behind every tree, like many did during the infamous witch hunt period. Today's Christians are enlightened Christians, unlike them. They just use it selectively, in every area except those rare areas that conflict with their pre-scientific sacred book. But, in fact, Reppert is incorrect about MN. MN does not prohibit supernatural explanations when investigating the historical claims of the Bible. It doesn't, most emphatically. It doesn't prohibit testing stories in the Bible with the science of archaeology, whether investigating the Exodus or the wilderness wanderings in the desert for 40 years, or the Canaanite conquest reported in Judges. Nor does it prohibit testing whether there was a census at the time of Jesus was born, nor does it prohibit testing the language style used by the writers of the Bible to see if there is more than one writer for Isaiah, or if 2 Peter was a forgery. It doesn't prohibit tests on petitionary prayer to show whether there is a supernatural deity, nor does it prohibit testing so-called prophecies. In fact, MN is the method used to test all these claims and more. If the results were positive for faith, those results would show us these claims are true, despite MN. Now, that's not the problem for MN. It's a problem for faith-based claims. If the method of MN successfully showed these claims to be true, believers would change their tune and crow about it. Because the results turned out differently, they must find some loophole to attack the method. Heads I win, tail you lose, right? MN by itself may not help tell us everything about the nature and workings of the universe, but it is only as reliable as the method works. It seeks natural causes for everything, so it is a limited method. However, what other method exists that can do a better job? We can rely upon MN to produce the goods. It is overwhelmingly probable, almost virtually certain given its past record. So where are we? God supposedly created a world that is best explained by a method that looks for natural causes if we want to learn about it. He did that on the Christian view. The method has gradually jettisoned supernatural explanations by scientifically literate people and by historians, and believers find themselves arguing against it, so they must argue against what their God did in order to believe in him. Don't you find that strange? That their God would put something in place that undermines their faith whereby they must selectively deny it to believe? And what is it they think excludes its grasp? An ancient pre-scientific barbaric superstition, unhistorical set of selected canonized sacred books as they interpret them in today's world. This does not make sense to me. Repert's God has failed him on two accounts. First, he created the world such that MN obtains if scientists want objective knowledge about the world and if historians want to know what happened in history. But the utilization of MN to investigate the world and history undercuts knowing that God created and acted in history. Second, even though MN does not exclude knowing that God acted in the world and in history, God has failed to provide the evidence that he did act or has acted. Some God, that is. Methodological naturalism works so well, it's very probable that nature is all there is. We must think exclusively in terms of the probabilities. We may misjudge the probabilities, but we should never go against them. MN has given us that knowledge. Faith has been wrong so many times, it should be obvious it cannot be relied upon to produce any knowledge. Faith adds nothing to our probability calculations. So let's recap. Christian apologists arbitrarily isolate the miracle claims of the resurrection of Jesus and exclude from consideration the antecedent probabilities that miracle claims in the ancient world always turn out to be false. Then they isolate miracle claims that have a religious context as having higher probability to them than other unexplained extraordinary events, even though most all miracle claims have a religious context to them. Next, they arbitrarily exclude from discussion everything but the minimal facts that believers and non-believers both accept, especially the overall trustworthiness of the Bible. Finally, they unreasonably exclude two important tools of the historian, the principle of analogy and methodological naturalism. Okay? Got it. So that's how it's done. That's a whole lot of isolating and excluding going on. But this is how it's to be done, folks. It's nothing more than special pleading in favor of Christian faith, pure and simple. It's a lot of empty rhetoric meant to bamboozle the uninformed and the logically impaired. These kinds of arguments only convince the already convinced, though. That's the nature of special pleading. It only has the appearance of defending the faith for people who already believe it. Chapter 8. You must punt to possibilities. Most Christian apologists believe that a fall into sin in the Garden of Eden damaged our rational cognitive powers to some degree. I think a much better explanation for how badly human beings reason relates to how our brains evolved. Nonetheless, even if our cognitive powers are damaged because of a fall in the Garden of Eden, this does not negate or diminish the need to present sufficient evidence to believe. Apologists must still present the evidence to believe regardless of the state of our rational cognitive powers. The task doesn't change. In this chapter, I intend to show how many times Christian apologists punt to the mere possibility that their faith is true, rather than consider the probabilities. My claim is that the more often Christian apologists resort to this defense, the less likely their faith is true. For the more often they use it, the more often they're admitting the evidence is not on their side. If the evidence were on their side, they would not have to defend their faith repeatedly, suggesting it is still possible their faith is true, despite underwhelming evidence to the contrary. I will go farther to suggest that, at several crucial points in the defense of their faith, some of the best Christian apologists have resorted to punting to the possibilities. The problem with this defense is obvious. When we are assessing the truth claims of Christian faith or any other religious faith, probabilities are all that matter. We should think exclusively in terms of them. Possibility arguments are not necessarily wrong to use in defense of a claim, since there are many cases where anomalies persist and need to be explained. My claim is that the crucial arguments on behalf of Christianity are based on possibilities, not probabilities. They are based on ad hoc hypotheses utterly unrelated to the strength of the evidence. To be a Christian is to believe against the overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Because of this, I must show the Christian faith is nearly impossible before Christians will consider it to be improbable, which is a reversal of how reasonable people should evaluate their faith. However, that being said, if you want to be an apologist, you must punt to possibilities, since so many of the best apologists do. If you want to be a good apologist, you shouldn't do this at all. But then if you didn't do it at all, you wouldn't be an apologist at all. It's possible that... Let's start with creationism. This is not the place to argue on behalf of evolution. Evolution is a fact. The evidence for it is overwhelming and convincing, even to the most believers. The implications for the Christian faith are enormous. The God hypothesis for the creation of human beings is unnecessary at best. The Adam and Eve story is a myth. There is no original sin, so there is no need to atone for it. Human beings are not special, nor even the highest creation, if for no other reason than we are still evolving. When we die, we cease to exist, just like every number of every other species. Nonetheless, believers will still try to argue that evolution is guided by God. That is, it is still possible that God exists, even though all life evolved. To see this, all we need to do is look at dog breeders who manipulate the breeding habits of their dogs to produce new breeds all the time. Some kind of God could act like these dog breeders by manipulating the environment and breeding habits of the various species on Earth to produce new ones. Doing so would not violate the evolutionary process, it's argued. It would merely inject purposeful direction into it. But how reasonable is it to suppose this scenario is the case? Not very. Such a scenario is possible, but what we want to know is if it is probable. It is also possible that the Loch Ness Monster exists but escapes all of our attempts to detect it. The first question we need to ask is, where is the evidence for such a claim? I don't see any God doing anything. Who does? The second question is, why, if a good, omnipotent creator exists, did he make the law of predation one of the centerpieces of his creative handiwork? Evolution works through the survival of the fittest. Nature is red in tooth and claw. The evolutionary process has forced animals to kill or be killed. Nearly 99% of all species that ever existed are extinct because the evolutionary process is extremely wasteful. This is surely not a good way for an omnipotent creator to create. If there is some supernatural force or being, it is not the God of Christian theology. A third question is, how does it benefit believers to say there is a supernatural force or being if that is all they can claim? Such a God is no different to none at all. Such a force would be a distant God, irrelevant to life in our pursuit of knowledge and happiness. He, she, it can safely be ignored. A fourth question is, where did the supernatural force or being come from? It doesn't explain anything to say it is necessary. Perhaps the universe or multiverse is the necessary being. I see no reason to suppose it isn't. In any case, while it is possible God exists, this is such a slim possibility given evolution that the more reasonable position by far is that such an entity is an unnecessary hypothesis that we can do without. If the God did it explanation is to be taken seriously, then modern science should not be able to offer so many viable alternatives to that explanation. Either Christians argue that the mysterious gaps in scientific knowledge to their particular God, or they don't. If they do, then they're arguing from ignorance, a well-known informal fallacy. If Christians don't argue from the gaps by claiming their God is merely the sustaining creator of the universe, then what we end up with is a universe that is indistinguishable from one without God at all. The probability that the Christian God hypothesis is the best explanation for the universe is inversely proportional to the amount of reasonable alternative scientific explanations there are, i.e., the more that science can explain, the less probable it is that God is the best explanation. And too many scientific explanations exist to suppose that the Christian God hypothesis explains anything at all. Let's turn to miracles. Christian apologists John King Farlow and William Niels Christen argue that just because we don't experience miracles today doesn't mean that throughout the history of mankind, God hasn't done a plethora of them and won't do so again when the time is right in the future. Their exact words are, an irregularity relative to a limited sample of our experiences might really be a regularity relative to a vastly larger sample. They are asking us to believe against the overwhelming present-day experience of nearly all modern people that things might turn out differently than we now experience. Is this impossible? No, not at all. But again, it's not improbable. Take as but one example among many the story of Balaam's ass spoke to him. The problem is not that Balaam thought his ass spoke to him. The problem is that someone believed him and wrote it up in the Bible. If today's Christians lived back in that superstitious era, they wouldn't believe this happened since all they had was Balaam's testimony. Back in Balaam's day, they themselves would not have believed it until Balaam made his ass talk in their presence. What Christians must first show is that a miracle could not have happened within the natural world because it was nearly impossible, or else it's not to be considered miraculous at all. Then we must turn around and claim such an impossible event probably took place anyway. So the probability that a miracle really did take place is inversely proportional to the probability that it could take place, i.e., the less probable it is considered to be, then the more probable it didn't happen at all. The improbability that a miracle took place defeats any attempt to show it probably took place. Furthermore, as we saw in Chapter 5 when discussing classical apologetics, when evaluating the evidence for a miracle, someone cannot presuppose any given particular God performed the miracle in question, since only the evidence of the miracle itself can give us good reason to think such a God exists in the first place. After all, non-Christian theists reject the evidence that Jesus was raised from the dead, even though they are theists. There are many other misfiring guns in the apologist's arsenal. It is still possible that petitionary prayers are efficacious even though scientific studies have shown they work just about as well as chance. It is still possible that even though the tools of the historian cannot detect miracles in the distant past, miracles took place in the past anyways. It is still possible that evangelical Christianity is true even though it is a late historical development to Christianity in general. It's still possible that even though Christians trust science in an overwhelming number of areas, they can still distrust it when it conflicts with what some ancient pre-scientific people wrote in a set of books believed to be sacred. Sure, all of these things are possible, but probabilities are all that matter. If we're going to talk about what is real, then we must think exclusively in terms of probabilities. The problem of religious diversity and hell. Consider why the Christian God will send people to hell who don't believe the right kinds of things, even though what people believe is overwhelmingly based on when and where they were born. William Lane Craig calls this the soteriological problem of evil and provides the answer by saying, "It is possible that God has so providentially ordered the world that those who fail to hear the gospel and be saved would not have freely responded affirmatively to it even if they had heard it." Or, in a different place, he talks instead of creation itself, that it is possible that God has created a world that has an optimal balance between saved and lost, and those who never hear the gospel and are lost would not have believed in it if they had heard it. In his argument to this effect, he uses the word possible in one section of a chapter 20 times on my count. Take, for instance, line from two back-to-back paragraphs when defending the traditional view of hell. "It is entirely possible that a God is all-powerful and all-loving, and that many persons hear the gospel and are lost. As a good and loving God, God wants as many people as possible to be saved and as few as possible to be lost. His goal, then, is to achieve an optimal balance between these, to create no more of the lost than is necessary to attain a certain number of the saved. But it is possible that the actual world has such a balance. It is possible that in order to create this many people who will be saved, God also had to create this many people who would be lost. It is possible that had God created a world in which fewer people go to hell, then even fewer people would have gone to heaven. It is possible that in order to achieve a multitude of saints, God had to accept a multitude of sinners." Following this, Craig offers possible answers to three different questions and claims afterwards, "These are possible answers to the question we pose, but so long as they are even possible, they show that there is no incompatibility between God's being all-powerful and all-loving and some people's never hearing the gospel and being lost." I am more than bewildered by this mere possibility of Craig's. If God exists, then presumably God decides where people are born and when. This means God has the kind of foreknowledge whereby, before people are born, he knows whether they would believe if they heard the gospel, and he places them on the earth appropriately. But if God has that kind of foreknowledge, he could foreknow who would not believe the gospel and never create them in the first place. Then Hotel Hell wouldn't even have one occupant. This possibility makes God out to be barbaric, a God who has had the chance to keep people out of hell but doesn't care to do so. The probability that the Christian God exists is inversely proportional to the amount of religious diversity that exists in the world, i.e., the more religious diversity there is in the world, the less probable it is that this Christian God exists. That there is just way too much religious diversity to suppose he does. But Craig isn't done yet. Along with J.P. Moreland, he opines, "We have no way of knowing that in a world of free creatures in which God's existence is as obvious as the nose on your face, that more people would come to love him and know his salvation than in the actual world." No way of knowing? Are they serious? In this mere possibility, they are attributing to human beings an irrationality that I find very disturbing. The probability that more people would believe is proportional to the amount of evidence that there is for Christianity in the world, i.e., the more evidence for Christianity there is in the world, the more people would believe. This seems self-evident to me. Possibilities don't count, only probabilities do. Given the amount of religious diversity in the world, there just isn't enough evidence for more people to believe in Christianity, period. What Craig describes are mere possibilities, akin to Plantinga's possibility that Satan is the cause of all natural suffering. I wish Christian apologists would stop trying to defeat the logical argument from evil against a good God, but they are simply stuck in the mode of thinking since Plantinga appears to have used it successfully. The problem is that Plantinga was responding to an argument that claimed evil was logically incompatible with a good God. The one Craig is responding to is not that type at all. He cannot respond to a probability type of argument with a possible defense as a thinking adult. Something is clearly wrong with his brain. He is not an honest seeker of the truth. Anyone in today's world who believes that there is an eternal conscious torment in hell for even the worst of sinners has serious mental health issues. I'm happy to report that traditional hell is on its way out. In this case, if you are an apologist, you must reject what Craig is doing, and yet he's recognized as one of the best apologists for Jesus. Randall Rouser's responses. Elsewhere, I have made a sustained case regarding what I call the problem of divine miscommunication. I argue that if God exists and revealed his will through the Bible, then he is an incompetent communicator. He did not have the slightest forethought for how his words would be misunderstood by his followers. Because of this, his words authorized the Inquisition, the Crusades, witch hunts, slavery, and the wars after the Protestant Reformation that caused 8 million Christians to slaughter each other over things most of them think are silly today. As but one example, all God would have to say is, "Thou shalt not buy or own slaves or beat them into submission," but he didn't. Christian apologist Randall Rouser responded to my argument by saying, "Now, is the Bible as effective as it could be? I just don't think we could say, as we are very much in the midst of history. Let's say that in 2 decades, the church reaches a pacifistic unanimity in the text, and this ushers in a time of world peace for the next 100,000 years. If this happened, and I don't know why it couldn't, then the text might indeed be maximally effective in the long term for establishing and maintaining the peaceable kingdom. I just don't think we have enough data to go on either way, and so the argument Loftus presents appears to be stillborn." In this case, Rouser puts to a future possibility rather than relying on the probabilities of the past and present, but the future hasn't arrived yet, so we cannot rely on it to help solve this problem. Even if the future turns out the way he hopes for, then that future was built on the backs of millions of people who suffered because God did not communicate his revelation clearly to his followers. The so-called revelation we find in the Bible is indistinguishable from God not revealing anything at all. It looks like it was written exclusively by ancient pre-scientific people who had no clue at all about the future. This has led many people through the ages to reject the Bible as revelation who were presumably cast into hell in the meantime. And Rouser thinks this is all good, that his God could not have done better. The probability that there is a good omniscient God behind the revelation in the Bible is inversely proportional to the amount of divine miscommunication we find in it, i.e., the more divine miscommunication we find in it, the less probable a good omniscient God is behind it. And there is just way too much divine miscommunication in the Bible. I've argued we should think exclusively in terms of probabilities. Faith has nothing to do with this reasoning process. Probabilities are all that matter. Faith is superfluous, utterly irrelevant, completely unnecessary, and even irrational. The probabilities are best described in Bayesian terms, something that can be done conceptually without the math. Rouser responded to what I've argued by saying I was wrong, for I left out the word probably. I should instead say we should probably think in terms of probabilities, leaving room for the possibility of faith. Others ask me to prove what I say or ask that I provide irrefutable, conclusive scientific evidence for it. Still others say it's practically impossible to think exclusively in terms of probabilities. All of these responses basically prove my point. Why would any rational person argue that we should not think exclusively in terms of probabilities? If the probabilities were on the side of Christianity, then apologists would be the first ones touting this and crowing through it. Rouser is correct, though. Whenever I make an argument, the reader must almost always insert words like probable or improbable into it. This is a given, but there are more specific words to be inserted, stretching from virtually impossible to virtually certain. In between these two extremes, there are a lot of different words that could describe the odds, stretching from extremely improbable to very improbable, to even odds, to slightly probable, to very probable, and to extremely probable. We don't have a word to differentiate between the odds on the continuum stretching from virtually impossible to virtually certain. But does anyone really want to suggest the word faith applies to all of these different probabilities, that there is the same amount of faith required to accept any one of them? If so, that is being irrational. Since Rouser is playing that game, then let me say instead that it is virtually certain or extremely probable that we should think exclusively in terms of probabilities. There is no better alternative, since this is how to think like a scientist. Science operates on the varying levels of probabilities. It's how we reasonably judge things in every other area of life except religion. Yes, it's possible that we could not think exclusively in terms of probabilities, but that conclusion is such a remote possibility, it's virtually impossible or extremely improbable. No, we don't always do this, so the fact that we don't think exclusively in terms of probabilities is not a criticism at all. We should. Every Bayesian statistical model has three components: the prior, the consequent or likelihood on the particular hypothesis, and the consequent or likelihood on the hypotheses being false. So for apologists who keep saying that life doesn't arise from non-life and that consciousness is hard to explain without reference to God, or that design implies a designer, the two hypotheses to be compared and contrasted would be 1, the non-supernatural viewpoint with the hypothesis that 2, one particular religious sect among the myriad that have existed, presently exist, and will exist in the future is true. When it comes to providing scientific evidence, we must think in Bayesian terms as well. The two hypotheses to be compared are 1, science helps us arrive at the truth, versus 2, faith helps us arrive at the truth. Since faith has no method and solves no problems, the probability that science helps us arrive at the truth is a virtually certain conclusion, whereas faith remains a virtually impossible conclusion. You see, we do not have to prove science leads us to think exclusively in terms of probabilities. We only need to show that it is, at the very minimum, extremely probable, but it is more than that. Probability is all that matters. Faith is irrational. I want to drive this point into the ground once and for all. The problem is that practically nothing is certain, so the word faith is used to describe any conclusion of ours that leaves room for doubt. It is possible I'm dreaming right now. I suppose that's an extremely remote possibility. Is it possible the material world does not exist? I suppose that's an extremely remote possibility too. Is it possible a good omnipotent God exists given the worldwide massive and ubiquitous suffering in it? Again, I suppose that's an extremely remote possibility. But so what? Probability is all that matters when it comes to matter of fact about the world we live in. Accepting a conclusion because it's merely possible is irrational. We should never ever do that. In fact, faith adds nothing to the actual probabilities at all. Having more of it or less of it does not change anything. If we have a virtually certain conclusion, we don't need faith at all. The only sense I can make of the way believers use that word faith is that it's an irrational leap over the probabilities. They fill in what the actual probabilities are with faith to stretch an improbable conclusion to reach an extremely probable one, and that is quite simply irrational. Faith cannot go beyond reason because that means it's going beyond the reasonable probabilities. There is no rational way faith can trump reason, or go beyond it, or even be based on it. A probability is a probability is a probability. There is nothing but probabilities and matters of fact about the world. It could still be the case that God cannot be known by use of the probabilities of reason, that a mere private personal subjective experience of God himself could circumvent all arguments and objective evidence to the contrary. Or maybe God values people willing to take an irrational leap of faith more than reasonable people who can only accept what the objective evidence leads them to accept in these matters. Maybe God simply chooses ways to reveal himself without any rhyme or reason, such as they are rational to believe even though God provides no solid objective evidence for others to believe, and even thwarts our reasoning processes by developing contradictory evidence. If believers have to resort to any of these kinds of defenses in order to believe, then there is probably little I can say to convince the otherwise. All we can do is look for solid objective evidence, and upon not finding it, reasonable people should not believe. If God wanted us to believe despite this lack of evidence, then for all I know, he could snap his hypothetical fingers and take away my critical thinking capabilities so that I would believe too. Or he could convert me in Damascus Road experience like Saul was, who converted without having his free will abrogated. Until such a time that happens, I cannot do differently, nor can I argue differently either. All I can do is focus on the probability of the arguments and the evidence. We need to think exclusively in terms of the probabilities when it comes to matters of fact like the nature of nature and which religion is true, if one is. If God exists and if he created us as reasonable people, then he created us to think this way. He created us to require that which he withholds from us. Strange that, God. Anomalies or possibilities? My claim is that in order to maintain and defend Christianity, the Christian must resort to offering possible scenarios at almost every turn. My claim is that the more Christians are forced to resort to these possible scenarios, then the less likely their background knowledge is true that forms the backdrop to legitimately use these possible scenarios in the first place. There are always some anomalies or unsolved mysteries that have not yet been solved when we hold certain things to be true. When it comes to these anomalies, we place them on the back burner and hope future discoveries or evidence will surface to help us solve them. And we can legitimately try to offer possible answers for how we think these anomalies can be solved. These anomalies are not considered probably true, but only possibly true. In the meantime, we interpret them in light of greater set of background ideas we hold to be probably true. But at almost every turn, the Christian faith is based on possibilities. So Christianity can only at best be known to be possibly true. There is no probability to their background knowledge at all. So resorting to possible scenarios is all they have. Since that is clear to demonstration, the Christian faith is only possibly true, not probably true. Time after time, Christians retreat to the merely possible when trying to defend their faith. Christians claim it's possible that an eternal three-in-one omni-God has always existed without ever learning anything or growing incrementally. Christians claim it's possible that an immaterial supreme being can act in the material universe even though they cannot show how this can be done. Christians claim it's possible there is divine intervention in the evolutionary process even though there is no room for it. Christians claim it's possible there is an answer to why God allows such massive and ubiquitous suffering in the world. Christians claim it's possible there is an explanation for how Jesus is 100% God and 100% man with nothing left over. Christians claim it's possible to gain sure knowledge about the historical past, which is enough to base an ultimate commitment to God upon. Christians claim it's possible that Jesus was resurrected even though the tools and methods of the historian don't lead us to think he was. Christians claim it's possible to reasonably accept second-hand testimony, at best, of a resurrection found in ancient written sources that cannot be interrogated, but it's not reasonable to accept someone's testimony who claims he levitated without seeing such a thing personally or without some personal interrogation. Christians claim it's possible that miracles occurred in the superstitious past, even though there is no credible evidence that they take place in today's world. Christians claim God may have possibly done a plethora of miracles in the past and will do so again in the future. Christians claim it's possible God can foreknow every human action, and yet those same human actions are truly free ones. Christians claim it's possible that the billions of people who have never heard the gospel of salvation wouldn't have accepted it even if they had heard it. Christians claim it's possible that the Christian faith is true even though evolution has enormous negative implications for religion. Christians claim it's possible that petitionary prayer are efficacious even though scientific studies have shown they work just about as well as chance. Christians claim it's possible that Christian faith is true and the others are of Satan, even though believers in different religious faiths adopt, defend, and believe with near certainty the religion of their culture. It's possible Christians are right after all, but then it's possible the Loch Ness Monster exists and is evading our attempts to detect her too. Christians must be convinced that their faith is nearly impossible before they will ever consider it to be improbable, which is an utterly unreasonable standard. The Omniscience Escape Clause. It doesn't matter what the particular problem is for a person's faith. Having an omniscient God concept solves it. It could be the intractable and unanswerable problem of ubiquitous suffering, or how a man could be 100% God and 100% man without anything left over, or left out, or how the death of a man on a cross saves us from our sins, or why God's failure to better communicate led to massive bloodshed between Christians themselves. It just doesn't matter. God is omniscient. He knows why. He knows best. Therefore, punting to God's omniscience makes faith pretty much unfalsifiable, which allows believers to disregard what reason tells them by ignoring the probabilities. There is only one way to convince Jesus that an omniscient God that their faith is false. They must be convinced their faith is impossible before they would consider it to be improbable, and that's an utterly unreasonable standard since the arguments to the contrary cannot hope to overcome the omniscience escape clause. So think on this. Given that there are so many different faiths with the same escape clause, let believers seriously entertain that their own God might equally be false. Sure, an omniscient God might exist, granted for the sake of argument, but how we judge whether or not he exists cannot rely over and over on his omniscience, since that's exactly how other believers defend their own culturally inherited faith. Reasonable people must not have an unfalsifiable faith, and yet an omniscient concept of God makes one's faith pretty much unfalsifiable. Believers must be forced to acknowledge that other believers in different religions or sects within their own who have the same concepts have the same exact problems when it comes to reasonably evaluating their own faith. and they too must be convinced that their faith is nearly impossible before they will consider it to be improbable, which is an utterly unreasonable standard of proof, making their faith pretty much unfalsifiable as well. This is something believers reject when it comes to evaluating the probability of other faiths. Why is it they don't reject this when it comes to their own? My goal is to force believers to see this. They must approach their faith with open eyes given the nature of religious faith concept. They must have a gestalt shift in the way they see their faith. Seeing things differently demands such a paradigm change in the fundamental way people view something. It can be facilitated with more knowledge and evidence, of course, but as with any encultured or indoctrinated mind, it might not be a product of change. It demands a willingness to see the Christian faith differently. Nothing less than that will do the trick. Chapter 9. You Must Gerrymander for God. I have used the term logical gerrymandering to describe what Christian apologists do in unfairly redistricting what people like me say out of context in order to gain an unfair intellectual advantage or so to ridicule us. I also use this phrase to describe what Christians do when caught in an